Americans say they desperately want a bipartisan Congress and a centrist president, according to a recent poll. But how do we get to that point, especially on the hot button issues of our health care?
There are some issues, and abortion is one where very, very difficult terrain for us to navigate. And there has to be sort of a desire on both sides also. So the way we identify issues that we focus on, Margaret, one is it has to be a critical health policy issue. Number two, it's got to be an issue where both sides need to be educated on, want to be educated on. And then third, there has to be some sort of policy window from a political science perspective.
Our guest and his colleagues are trying to find a path. Dr. Anand Parekh is chief medical advisor at the Bipartisan Policy Center. He previously served in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Health.
We were instrumental, for example, in ensuring that Medicare Advantage plans through supplemental benefits are able to provide non-medical benefits like housing, nutrition, transportation. We were critical in the passage of the 21st Century Cures Act that really accelerated medical research.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, Doctor, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much, Mark. Great to be with you and Margaret.
Yeah, that's great. You know, we certainly know the Bipartisan Policy Center have had many folks on over the years, but I'm wondering if our audience knows as well, and I want to really pick up on something you say on your website. We never ask anyone to surrender their bipartisan beliefs, but the best solutions emerge from the give and take between political opponents. I'm wondering if you could just share more with our listeners about how you see that play out.
Sure, happy to do so. You know, there's a difference between being nonpartisan, there are a lot of nonpartisan organizations, and being bipartisan, and it's a pragmatic difference. So we believe that individuals shouldn't have to check their ideology at the door. So we certainly want partisans. We just want them to come to the table, be able to have a discussion, and be able to work together to solve our nation's challenges. We are the only entity, I will say now in Washington, D.C., still with the word bipartisan in our title. And that is, I guess, a sign of our times. But we think that this work is really important. We think the American public believes bipartisanship is important. And so we've been around, we're pretty young, for about 15 years now to provide a space for both Democrats and Republicans. And we take the best ideas from both sides to promote health security and opportunity.
Well, that's saying something when you note that there's only one organization with the word bipartisan and its title. And Dr. Parekh, I think you reasonably take credit for helping a number of bills get across the finish line. The Policy Center takes credit for getting a number of bills across the finish line. Share with our listeners, where would we find or where can you direct us to where the impact has been felt in healthcare legislation of the work that your organization does?
Sure. So we are a 501c3 organization, nonprofit organization. We have a sister 501c4 arm, BPC Action, and they are able to really provide leadership in the advocacy. So we have a mantra here at BPC: when we press print on our reports and recommendations, we're only 50% of the way there. And so it's really impact what we're after. But if you look at over the last 10 years, BPC has played an important role, I would say, in the healthcare discussion and debate here. We were instrumental, for example, in ensuring that Medicare Advantage plans through supplemental benefits are able to provide non-medical benefits like housing, nutrition, transportation. We were critical in the passage of the 21st Century Cures Act that really accelerated medical research. We played a critical role in reauthorization of the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute to really propel comparative effectiveness research. We've been tracking opioid spending at the federal level for the last several years, given the overdose epidemic, and both Congress and the administration have done a better job tracking those dollars to assess effectiveness. So those are just sort of a number of areas mm-hmm. where we've tried to provide, we think, some critical leadership. And then, of course, the pandemic, which we've just come out of, we were really on the forefront there trying to advocate for a new White House office on pandemic preparedness policy, which now Congress has helped create to really ensure that coordination, that whole of government response that we need when it comes to pandemics are there. So in a number of different areas, we've tried to help move the ball forward, I would say.
You know, speaking of moving the ball forward and the need for critical leadership, you may know that many of those in our audience are in the primary care arena. Some say primary care is dead. Maybe it's on life support. Only 5% of the dollars spent are on primary care. There are fewer providers coming into the primary care area. I'm wondering if you could just shape up for us where you think there may be bipartisanship in terms of promoting primary care. Is this an important issue to the bipartisan center and to your supporters?
Well, I'll start with myself first as a primary care physician, and though I'm not seeing patients at the current time, this is absolutely, I think, the most important health care related issue in America. Primary care, a strong primary care system, needs to be the foundation of our healthcare system. So many of what is ailing us is because we haven't, as you said, put in the resources, the investment into our primary care infrastructure. And in terms of the Bipartisan Policy Center, I can say, every report, it doesn't matter what the topic, we always try to ensure that we are recommending the support of the primary care system, whether it's behavioral health and trying to tackle mental health and substance use, whether it's strengthening the Medicaid program. In all of these areas, primary care is so important. I'll just give you sort of two examples that we are tracking. Over the last several months, and this came to fruition on March 12th, the Bipartisan Policy Center helped relaunch the Congressional House Primary Care Caucus. So this is a caucus that was dormant for a number of years, and we ended up identifying four members, two Democrats, two Republicans, to really co-chair this caucus. We had a relaunch event in March 12th. In fact, the board chair of the National Association of Community Health Centers, as well as the CEO and president of the Primary Care Collaborative, were speakers. We heard from all four of the members. I had a number of offices there represented the primary care community as well. So at least there is now a flag back in the House about the importance of really educating members on primary care. And I see this group, and they have about four dozen members, really providing that education. There are a lot of new staff, a lot of new members. Before we even get into policy, it's really, really important that people understand the state of primary care in the United States and why we need to strengthen it. So I'm really pleased about that. And we're also now working on the Senate side, where there's some momentum with respect to payment reform as they think through how do we better support primary care physicians, primary care providers more broadly in this country. And those are conversations happening. We're involved in those conversations.
Well, that is really good to hear. I'd not heard about the relaunch of the Congressional Caucus, and I think the timing with the primary care scorecard that the Milbank Fund released recently, saying things are getting worse, not better, despite the NASM report, is certainly a compelling stimulus for that kind of work. But I wonder, and thank you for that focus on primary care, to get within some of the other issues in healthcare. You wrote in JAMA about what you called the four defining health issues of the presidential election, said the biggest one is reproductive rights, which transcends primary care, really all domains of health and healthcare in the country. But Kaiser Family Foundation, which I think is more commonly now called KFF, the KFF health tracking poll, found that nearly half of Democratic voters say they're going to vote only for a candidate who shares their view on abortion, more than twice the share of Republican voters who say the same. On an issue such as abortion, how do you and your colleagues navigate a bipartisan approach? I have to imagine this is one of the more challenging issues that you face.
Yeah, you know, there are some issues, and abortion is one where very, very difficult terrain for us to navigate. And there has to be sort of a desire on both sides also. So the way we identify issues that we focus on, Margaret. One is it has to be a critical health policy issue. Number two, it's got to be an issue where both sides need to be educated on, want to be educated on. And then third, there has to be some sort of policy window from a political science perspective. Either Congress is looking at this issue, the administration is. Abortion, and there are some issues like that, very, very difficult for us to navigate, and it has not been one of the core issues of focus for us, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to stay on the legal challenges that are faced, and also on the primary care area. I did not realize there were about 2,000 cases challenging the ACA, but there's one in Texas, the Braidwood Management case, which is really going at the heart of providing preventative services by private insurance groups at no cost. And this is under challenge. It again gets back to the issue of the assault that's going on, essentially preventative primary care services, making them available. What are your thoughts about this? Is this a serious challenge? This judge seems to be a plaintiff's judge, but what's your view on this, and what should our listeners be keeping an eye on?
Yeah, unfortunately, this is a serious challenge. It's such an important issue. Hundreds of millions of Americans right now are getting evidence-based clinical preventive services through their commercial insurer without any cost sharing. That's the way it should be. These are high-value, evidence-based services. And essentially, this lawsuit would declare this provision of the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional under the Appointments Clause of the U.S. Constitution, essentially that the body, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, the lawsuit contends, hasn't been presidentially appointed, confirmed by the Senate, so they don't have the standing. They also cite the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, saying that, for example, HIV preventive services ought not to be covered. And so this is a serious challenge. The appeals court is looking at this. This will probably go to the Supreme Court eventually. I hope there's some sort of resolution, perhaps maybe that those businesses, just narrowly to them. But it would be a big blow if in fact this was ruled null and void, because you could be then in a scenario where we were pre-ACA, where many people wouldn't be able to access these preventive services. Now, fortunately, we're seeing insurers and employers right now say the right things, that these are important, irrespective of what happens in the court of law. They're going to keep these and not start cost sharing, but we don't know whether that's going to be true for all insurers. And so I think it is something for listeners and viewers to track. I think we all realize how important it is to get immunizations, to get cancer screenings, to get mental health and substance use counseling services. And cost is not the only barrier, but it is an important barrier. The ACA tries to take it off the table. Hopefully it'll remain that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say from the front lines, you're right, it's not the only one, but it's about 90% of the reasons that people used to give in the, what I like to think of as the olden days, and hope they'll stay that way. But I want to talk about another area that's contentious, maybe in the public eye, that you've written about, and that is a link that Republicans sometimes make between the immigration issue and public health, and not a positive link. You point out that unauthorized immigration has corresponded with an increase in customs making fentanyl seizures. Democrats see these two issues as unrelated, but I think there's probably larger issues there about how our legislators perceive immigration and public health. How do you think about this dilemma when you're trying to get people to consensus?
Well, this has traditionally been a bipartisan issue, at least for the last few years. And, our overdose epidemic in this country continues to claim over 100,000 lives every year. We need both a supply and demand strategy here, supply in terms of curbing the flow of illicit fentanyl coming into the United States. But that can't be the only strategy. We also need to pair that with continued efforts in prevention and treatment, looking at the healthcare side. Naloxone is critical, medication-assisted treatment, or medications for opioid use disorder, absolutely critical as well. So, you know, all of these things are going to be important. There's no magic bullet here. The illegal immigration issue is one that could be linked, even though it's a pretty tenuous link, because most of the illicit fentanyl that is coming from Mexico is coming actually through legal border checkpoints. It's not coming through illegal migrants sort of illegally coming into the United States. That being said, these two issues are often linked. I think the more important issue is that, you know, whichever administration, you know, is there in 2025, have both an important demand prevention treatment as well as supply side strategy to reduce overdose deaths in this country.
You know, you talked just now about a magic bullet, and I know you've written about the looming insolvency of the Medicare Hospital Trust Fund. Doesn't seem like we have many folks who want to take this issue on. I think there's bipartisan assessment that the trust fund is in trouble, but there doesn't seem to be any collective action. What should we think about this particular problem, how large it looms for the country, and is there any seam of opportunity during an election year in which there should be robust debate, that there will be debate on this issue?
You know, not surprisingly, in an election year, this is an issue, I would say, that's not going to get the attention that it deserves. I think both candidates have already been on the record, you know, and this can be politicized very quickly. And I think they realize that. And so other than saying that no benefits will be cut with respect to Medicare and Social Security, neither candidate really wants to get into it. But I do think that come 2025, regardless of the makeup of Congress and the administration, you know, our report really indicated that these are issues that we ought to be talking about. Insolvency is looming, you know, 2031, 2033, you know, around that time frame, which is not too far from now. And so understanding exactly, you know, the program, where it's going, understanding where we can reduce waste in the program, whether it's essentially resources that are not going to improve outcomes, where is it that we can do a better job in terms of working, whether it's with Medicare Advantage, whether it's working with the hospital sector, whether it's working with the pharmaceutical sector, how do you simplify from the beneficiary perspective, them making the best choices they can. It's often difficult trying to compare traditional Medicare and Medicare Advantage. How do we make sure that we align the incentives, invest in primary care? So there's so many issues when it comes to Medicare solvency. And I think at some point, we're going to really need a bipartisan discussion. That's really what our report a couple of months ago was about. We knew that it probably wouldn't get a lot of attention this year, but hopefully it'll get some more attention next year.
Well, Dr. Parekh, we will all have the indelible cry, hands off my Medicare, from the run-up years to the Affordable Care being passed. And I don't think the Affordable Care Act has generally stimulated that kind of hands off my Affordable Care Act insurance in the general population. But you've said that you don't think we need to worry too much about Republicans repealing the Affordable Care Act, despite what former President Trump has said on the campaign trail. But from your center's position, are you not concerned that there'll be an attempt to do death by a thousand cuts to the Affordable Care Act with subsidies, or as we talked about, mandates for 100% upfront payment of preventable screenings? What do you think is likely to happen with the Affordable Care Act if there's a Republican administration?
Well, I think the big debate will be in Congress actually next year, because in December 2025, the advanced premium tax credits will expire, and Congress will have to decide whether or not to extend those. Because of those tax credits this year, I think the administration has said there have been over 21 million Americans who have signed up to the Obamacare or the ACA exchange, is sort of a record number. Right. They've been, you know, much more generous. And so I actually do think that specific issue, I didn't write about this in my JAMA article, but I do think that President Biden and Democrats will tout that, the success of the Affordable Care Act exchanges. Now, some Republicans may counter and say, well, that may be so, but for so many people, they are still facing high deductibles and narrow networks in those plans. So I think you'll see a debate there. But then certainly next year for Congress, this extension would require resources and taking into account the federal deficit and debt and a focus on fiscal issues. I think Congress is going to have to figure out, you know, how to extend this. And there'll be an ideological debate. There'll be a fiscal debate. But I do think, Margaret, that I think it's really going to be the extension of the advanced premium tax credit vis-a-vis ACA. There are other issues, I think, if a Republican administration came in, they'll look at how do you create more flexibilities in the market, short-term plans and other things during the first Trump administration that they focused on. I could see them focusing on that once again as well.
So you would say that these are things that might decrease people signing up on the exchange for it, but wouldn't really fundamentally alter the Affordable Care Act's coverage and structure?
I think that structure is here to stay. I think you've even heard from some, you know, Republicans that you know, the Affordable Care Act, much of it is so entrenched, particularly on the insurance side, into our healthcare system, that, you know, and there's no replacement as well, back to your point. And so I do think that is here to stay. I think it's a matter of tweaking it based on ideology, and as well as, more importantly, how do you strengthen it so it can be more impactful and effective to support the American public.
Speaking of more impactful and effective, we've seen the new rise of these obesity drugs. I know you wrote a book called Prevention First, in which you advocated for greater measures to reduce preventable diseases. The book came out before the obesity drug hit the market. I'm wondering what you think about the drugs, the role the federal government should do in paying for these drugs as a way to reduce the incredible skyrocketing of diabetes rates tied to obesity, and other thoughts that you might have in terms of this the release of these GLP drugs.
Well, I do think that obesity is, if not the most important, one of the most important challenges, health challenges that this country is facing today and will face this century with 4 in 10 adults with obesity, which is a medical condition, 2 in 10 children with obesity as well. Again, also with obesity, there is no sort of magic or silver bullet. It requires a focus on everything from food policy, healthcare policy, education. I do think that these medications are critically important, a scientific breakthrough based on the data and the evidence that we've seen. Of course, we're going to have to see sort of long-term studies and see whether the effectiveness continues and how long you might have to be on these medications. Is there an off-ramp? But certainly these medications, from an effectiveness perspective and a safety perspective, are a far cry, much better than they were than the medications from 2 decades ago. I think the biggest policy issue right now is, if you go back 20 years to the Medicare Modernization Act, Congress put in statute there that the Medicare program cannot provide coverage for any medications related to weight loss. Back then, 20 years ago, we knew much less about obesity. The medications were not safe. So these were considered sort of cosmetic-related conditions. Now we know obesity is a medical condition. And so I think there is tremendous bipartisan support for Congress to revisit that issue, to allow the Medicare program the ability to at least assess the evidence and decide on coverage of these medications. Of course, since Congress gets involved, that means the Congressional Budget Office would need to get involved as well, and they would need to score this legislation so there would be a price tag with it. And I think some of the reasons why we haven't seen Congress move on that is trying to figure out how to pay for that and what the offsets would be. But I do think that Congress should provide Medicare the ability to assess the evidence as well as cover these medications. They are they come with a high price tag. And so hopefully with both competition as well as negotiation over the next couple of years, those prices can come down. So I think they're an important part of the armamentarium.
Right. Speaking of negotiations, do you think you'll see these drugs move up to the 10 that the government gets to choose in terms of negotiating rates?
Not immediately. It's going to take some time. You know, and I have to go back. I think the particular molecule was first approved by the FDA in 2016 or 2017. So there is sort of an 8 or 10 year window of exclusivity. But over the next few years, you could imagine that Medicare could consider GLP-1 agonists. But first, Medicare would need to be able to cover the drug in the first place.
Well, Dr. Parikh, I want to pivot to children for a few moments before we wrap up. You were involved in a report that said that the United States should ensure that all children, regardless of household income, have access to nutritious food to allow them to learn and grow, including during the summer when schools are obviously traditionally out of session. But I understand we have Republican governors in 15 states who are rejecting summer food money for kids, saying they don't believe in welfare. And even saying, you know, we have a youth obesity problem and that should be a counteraction to that, I guess. Is this one of those points where your organization can say, no, the opponents are just wrong? Or how do you advance this one on a bipartisanship basis?
Yeah, I think on this one, what we're trying to show that the evidence over the last 10 years demonstrates that these programs, child nutrition programs, in fact, do improve health and reduce obesity. And so this is really, a way of starting young, focusing on the evidence, focusing on schools, meeting children and families where they are. And obviously this was really important during the pandemic, but even, now it's just really important that there is an opportunity for children and families to get healthy meals. And I think there are a number of many Republican governors who accepted the dollar. So it's not purely a Democrat versus Republican thing, but there are holdouts, as you stated. I think this is a very sort of cost effective way to really invest in our young generation. And again, nutrition, one of the most important issues, tackling childhood obesity. And we know that from a health perspective, this ties into to educational readiness as well. So it's just such an important issue.
You know, I want to, one last question. Bipartisanship is key, but you walked the walk because you served in both the George W. Bush and Barack Obama administrations. I'm wondering, how did you manage to serve both administrations, and how has it informed your work? And do you see this as a exemplar of future opportunities for people to serve in both Republican or Democratic administrations, or you think we're too divided as a country for that to happen today?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I was actually a career civil servant throughout, and that's the reason I was able to, to be there for 10 years. But, I just believe that we're too divided of a country, and sometimes artificially, whatever we can do to work with both sides, no one side has a monopoly on good issues. And so I think that was always part of my DNA, that most people have good intentions on both sides. We just need people to work together and help the country come together. And I think that's why I spent 10 years at HHS and why I was drawn to an organization like the Bipartisan Policy Center to try to take the best idea from best ideas from everyone. So I hope to continue to do that.
Dr. Parikh, thank you so much for your time, for your work, and for sharing your insights. And thanks to our audience for being here. Be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube. Find us on Facebook and X with our account name CHC Radio. And as always, you can go online to chcradio.com, sign up for our updates, and also please share your thoughts and your comments about this program with us. Dr. Parikh, thank you again so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you.
This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.